You may be seated. Our last case this morning is 14-197, Disciplinary Counsel versus Scott Clifford Smith. For the respondent, Mr. Donchance.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, my name is Ken Donchance. I represent Scott Smith, the respondent today. He's seated in the courtroom behind me with his wife, Lori. This case is about fairness and process, and that's why we filed our objections. On the one hand, there was very little process from the very first day of the investigation, which started in-house with Western Heard and then went to their outside counsel and then eventually came to the relator. Because the people conducting the investigation failed to review the Serengeti billing system, which you saw highlighted in our objections and took up a lot of time at the hearing. Nor did they allow Mr. Smith to access that system during the investigation so that he could prove his innocence to the investigators, whatever level of investigation we were looking at.
Counsel, wouldn't he have had the opportunity to issue a subpoena or to ask for a subpoena?
We did. Initially, Your Honor, we asked for it in discovery requests. Initially, we revealed the existence of Serengeti during the investigation. And then in January of 2011, our discovery responses to the relator contained a good discussion of what that was and what it contained. In November of that year, November 2011, we asked for a full and working copy of Serengeti from the relator in our discovery requests and followed those up in February of that next year with a supplemental discovery asking for Serengeti, but also its companion programs, Power Brief and Client Connect.
Where did you make those requests? To whom?
To the relator. And we even had a pre-hearing conference with the panel chair about whether the relator possessed that information or whether they could obtain it or give it to us.
Did you get a ruling from the panel chair?
She ruled that the relator should give us everything in its possession. And so we went through a document review and then submitted a report back to the panel of all the documents that the parties had exchanged, and that became part of the record. Subsequent to that, we decided to take discovery depositions, and so I issued three subpoenas geared toward getting the Serengeti system so that we could use them during the discovery depositions. And those subpoenas contained 49 categories of documents. Each one of those categories reflected part of the Serengeti system. So the idea was that somebody would give us access to the system, and those were issued to Western Heard, by the way, not to the relator. The idea was that we would have supervised access to Serengeti, not, you know, free reign to just trifle through the system, but some kind of supervised access prior to the depositions, and we could look at it, we could print it out, or obtain a copy of it somehow, and then we could use it in Scott's defense. In response to that, Western Heard filed an objection to each of the subpoenas, and the relator filed a motion for a protective order, which was almost immediately granted. So we were prevented at that point from looking at Serengeti, and then that brought us right up to the hearing. So we go into the hearing, but at the hearing, we find out that there's a document from Serengeti that's in the relator's exhibits, and Mr. Smith testified about that because during the course of the investigation and during the course of discovery, he had insisted on the position that his billing narratives were turned into codes, and those codes, through Serengeti, were sent to the insurance companies for payment. And then the insurance company would either approve or deny the bill and send back a check to Western Heard. When we looked in the relator's book, there was a page with a code on it, and Mr. Smith said, here it is, this is what I've been talking about, here's the code all this time. As the relator pointed out in their brief, we also received some Serengeti documents from Western Heard in the underlying mediation. They weren't useful, they didn't prove anything about this case, but they at least showed us that Western Heard had the ability to print out the documents and access a working copy of that database, and that we could then build on that and potentially get it during discovery for the hearing. So we know at the day the hearing starts that that database has been accessed two times, once by whomever compiled the exhibits for the relator and once by Western Heard when they gave us their documents in the underlying mediation. But still, at that point, we were prevented from accessing it. We were never allowed to access it to perfect Mr. Smith's defense. And as we come here today, we still haven't seen it. We've done everything we possibly could. We've asked for it in discovery. We've tried to subpoena it. We tried to get it in the underlying mediation, and still no one has let us have it.
So your defense to the determination of the board is that you didn't have the adequate process, due process,
that is one of our defenses.
Prepare your defense because the motion, the subpoenas have been quashed and you have been denied access to this information.
That is correct, Your Honor. You know, there are a couple of questions here that come out of that. One is, when you have a respondent who is contesting the underlying facts, as opposed to a respondent who stipulates and then we come here and we do a mitigation hearing, which you are well familiar with, I'm sure, there is a duty on the part of the prosecutor to look at exculpatory evidence, and Rule 3.8 is directly on point. It says that the prosecutor, especially here in a quasi-criminal hearing, has a duty to look at exculpatory evidence. And Mr. Smith's story hasn't changed in 7 full years since he stopped practicing. He has always, during that 7 years, insisted that the Serengeti database contains the full record of every transaction, every communication, every bill, every time entry that he ever submitted to the insurance companies. Not to the clients, because they were subrogated. They're over here on the side. The insurance companies are front and center in this case because they subrogated the nursing home clients, and they took over the defense. So they set up the budgets, which are contained in Serengeti. They accepted the bills, which are contained in Serengeti. And they communicated with Mr. Smith through Serengeti. And so that is the basic problem with the case. And
counsel, is there a civil action with Weston Hurd and your client?
There was, and under the partnership agreement, both parties decided to go to mediation because the agreement commands mediation first.
What happened there?
Weston Hurd pulled out. They said they would prefer that this process go forward before they resolve the partnership agreement.
Okay, so that's yet to be determined.
It is, and hence you have Mr. Smith's testimony that Weston Hurd is using this process as a sword and a shield because they want a finding from you that there was misconduct so that they can have an advantage in the mediation.
What has your client been doing for the last 7 years since he stopped practicing?
He's been working for private companies as an executive, but he is not. He's not currently working, and he hasn't practiced law since he was terminated from Western Herd. Okay. So the relief we would like from you today is either a dismissal of the claim based on our due process claims or a remand with an order to provide the respondent with access to Serengeti. I think that's well within the power of the court to order. It is important because it is exculpatory evidence. Everyone who testified agreed that the database existed. Everyone agreed that the insurance companies used it. The clients, Paul Kleen and John Goodman, who testified, said that they didn't use it and they weren't familiar with it, but they didn't deny that it existed. And so this is an unusual case because usually in attorney discipline cases, you don't have a big due process argument where an attorney has been deprived of the ability to gain evidence for a defense.
But were there not handwritten entries, though, that were produced?
Those were internal Western Herd records, and they were the kind of time entries that an attorney would write when they're sitting at their desk.
And they covered all of the time at issue, correct?
We think so, but there wasn't a lot of testimony about that at the hearing. There was only testimony about one set of the time entries where it was the repetitive ditto marks. We didn't go through the time entries exhaustively.
But weren't those the time entries that were used for the client billings?
They were. They were converted into code, and what happens is during that conversion process, they may change. There was a secretary or a clerk who was entering that. And so what we wanted to see was the final product so we could see what was actually submitted for payment. That's what we don't have in this record. We don't have the final product that was actually submitted for payment.
The actual dollars that were the subject here, they didn't comport with the handwritten notes?
That's the allegation. But what we need to do is...
Allegation is that they did not.
That's the allegation is that it's twofold, that the handwritten notes were just false time written down, and that the final invoices were somehow altered by Scott to either increase the time or to put time for a different attorney under his name. You know, I don't think that the record is very clear that that was proven, and I covered that in my objections pretty extensively. It does lead us to another issue, though, Your Honor, and then that is the issue of damages.
Counsel, before you go to that issue, you used the term terminated, and I'm reading the findings of fact, and it looks to me like in August, your client was told that they planned to contact his clients, and the following day he sent them an email saying, I'm resigning.
That is correct, but there's a piece missing there in that he was suspended, and he was not permitted to go back into his office.
No, I understand that, but you used the word terminated. Was he terminated, or did he quit?
I believe he was terminated. I believe effectively that was a termination. Yes.
Counsel, how do you answer the statement in the record here that the board says, respondent admitted that his billing descriptions bore no relation to the work he actually performed on any given case? How do you get around that? Was there an admission of that?
There was not a wholesale admission that way. That's a very broad statement, and that's not what the transcript reflects.
What did he admit then?
He admitted that the insurance companies had told him that if his billing is discoverable, it presented a risk to the insurance companies. So he needed to craft his narratives in a very general sense so that if those were discoverable, the opposing party couldn't glean client strategies, client communications, and things like that from the attorney billing. So that is what he said. So if he did a bunch of discovery, he would just put a single entry in that said, attention to discovery.
So it wasn't the amount of time that he was indicating per each entry, it what the content was?
That is correct. The issue is the narratives. There was no evidence that his time was inflated. We never discovered any evidence of that. The witnesses didn't testify to that. There was some debate about whether it takes 15 minutes or 30 minutes to do an end-of-the-month summary to a client, but, you know, that's individual attorneys have different styles and different paces. But there was no other evidence beyond that.
The law firm gave money back to his clients?
They did, and that actually, that's the damages issue. You know, in the beginning of the case, there was actually a ruling limiting the case to the five matters that were contained in the formal complaint. But then during the testimony, people testified as to the amount of damages that were given back to the client. And the amount of damages was based on the 88 clients, the 88 files that were reviewed. So that did not comport with the hearing panel's ruling. And I believe that that did prejudice the panel because it showed that there was these huge amounts of money going back to the client when that clearly should have been excluded under the initial ruling. And I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. I thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Beckman.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Stacy Solacek-Beckman on the behalf of the Relator Disciplinary Council. There are several things that the Respondents' Council has just indicated that I want to address, and first is going to go to what Justice Lanzinger asked about how do you get around the statements that they were false in the records. This wasn't just a matter of where the narratives were false. This was a matter of where, in many cases, the narratives were completely inaccurate or completely unavailable to be proven. The files, the five client files that we're talking about, had no documentary evidence supporting what the narrative said and indicating what work was actually completed on those things. And what the respondent testified to was not only that they were inaccurate, but that there was no correlation between what the narratives that he put on his invoices, on his handwritten notes, which then became the client invoices, no correlation between that and what he actually did. So for instance, we've talked about the ditto marks where he would put the same thing that the respondent would put that he had completed the same work on the same matter over and over and over again, up to 10 times in one instance, where he spent the same amount of time in each matter. But in the five files that we looked at, there was no work in those files correlating to the respondent's description of time.
Would any of that be disclosed in the Serengeti database?
I'm glad you asked that. What the Serengeti database was, and this was testified to by Paul Killeen, who was the general counsel for Beverly Corporation, or Golden Living, it's called both, which is the only one of the three clients that use Serengeti. What the Serengeti was a billing program. In order to make it easier for Golden Living to receive their bills, they required their counsel, and all over the state, all over the country, to upload the invoices into this program. It would then come to them over Serengeti. They could make changes on Serengeti as to the invoices. They could make deductions. They could ask questions, and they would send that back. The testimony was, however, that the information on the Serengeti invoices was exactly the same as the information on the Western Herd invoices.
Why could he not then have it to verify that? Why wouldn't the respondent have a right to look at it?
The respondent,
if you say there's testimony that it's exactly the same, doesn't the respondent have the right to review it?
What the respondent had the right to review were the documents that Relator received regarding Serengeti, which Relator provided to him on those five cases.
How could someone make a representation that the Serengeti information was exactly the same as what had been there and yet not let the respondent test that or review it in discovery?
Well, I think that my answer to that is twofold. First of all, only respondent made the representation that the Serengeti was necessary and exculpatory to him. There was no other evidence that supported that. But secondly, respondent could have subpoenaed those records. He could have subpoenaed them and provided Western Herd ample amount of time to address and respond. What he did was he waited until 2 days before the deponent's depositions were scheduled and issued a subpoena at that time seeking those 49 specific items. That's when he subpoenaed the records. It was not as though he was denied that right to subpoena them earlier. He was never denied the right to subpoena the clients. He was never denied the right to subpoena the third-party administrators. He chose not to do any of those things. In the same vein,
are you therefore saying that the subpoena, the motion to quash, was granted on a timeliness basis, not on a subject matter basis?
Absolutely. That's what we're saying.
You're saying we're 48 hours from the hearing. I'm not going to stop this hearing and go get paper.
It was
because we are comparing paper to electronic at this point, aren't we?
Well, there's both. What the respondents,
that would be a yes.
That would be yes. The subpoenas that were issued sought both electronic information as well as, I believe, other documentary information. I think, and I'm trying to recall off the top of my head, one of the things they sought were billing records for all of the partners at Western Herd for a very extensive period of time.
You would agree, therefore, in response to Justice O'Donnell, that if this person is alleging that the billing questions are what I'm being charged with, and I don't have access to the paper that generated those billing questions, that would be a denial of due process, would it not? You can't just have somebody come in with a
wishy-washy there.
I understand that, but you can't just have somebody come in with a computer printout and say, trust me, everything behind this computer printout is accurate.
And I think that that would be true, but I think that respondent, if he was denied due process, if he didn't get those records, that was the respondent's doing. He could have subpoenaed those records and chose not to.
Thank you.
Counsel, the recommendation of the board is indefinite suspension and that he can't get back in until he pays the restitution, which I assume is the $350,000.
The board's findings left that open. That the restitution would be determined based upon an agreement between Western Herd and the respondent, whether that was through the course of continued mediation or some other way.
Okay. So, that was my question. Is it seems like there's perhaps a big dispute as to the amount of, if anything, that the Wesson Hurd should have paid back to the clients?
Certainly the respondent disputes the amount that Wesson Hurd paid to the clients. That's correct.
If I understood Mr. Deschamps' argument with respect to damages, he said that the amount was based on 88 files, and yet this case was limited to 5 files. Was there any evidence of what the damages in the 5 client files at issue amounted to?
There was not. The only specific evidence relating to damages was how much Wesson Hurd paid the clients, which was $350,000.
And that was more than the 5 clients at issue in this
Correct.
Case.
Correct. That related to many more, not many more clients. There were only 3 clients, but many more cases.
Okay, 88 files.
88 files for 3 cases, or for 3 clients, rather.
Okay, thank
That's
you.
That's correct.
Thank you.
And when we discussed, as Justice Pfeiffer mentioned, the indefinite suspension, that is not an unduly harsh sanction in this matter. This is for 4 reasons. If we look at the case precedent that's been previously decided, if we look at the respondent's conduct and the harm it caused, the panel found that the respondent changed and padded his bills to which he alone had access. The panel found that he made self-serving statements and misrepresentations that were indicative of a calculated attempt to avoid accepting responsibility for his misconduct. If we look at the lack of mitigating evidence, the respondent offered no mitigation in this case. The only mitigating evidence is the lack of a prior disciplinary record, whereas there are significant aggravating factors. Those would include that there was a dishonest and selfish motive. There was testimony that directly linked the amount of money that respondent billed his clients to the amount of money that respondent earned. There is a pattern of misconduct. He engaged in this conduct over a period of 3 years involving 3 different clients. He caused financial harm to both the clients and the firm. He's refused to acknowledge his wrongful conduct. This is in despite of the face of overwhelming evidence. And he's failed to make restitution. Respondent had no evidence
He's failed to make restitution. The restitution's in dispute.
Correct.
So you're going to put that on the side against mitigation when we don't even know what that's supposed to be?
The panel found that that was an aggravating factor.
Counsel, was the respondent the managing partner of the firm when all this occurred?
He was. He was the managing partner of the firm and the head of the long-term care practice group, which all 3 of these clients were part of.
And he was the one that was directly billing the clients, you're saying? There was no other individual implicated in this?
The way the billing system worked at Wesson Hurd is that the originating partner, or the billing partner, which in this case was respondent, was the individual who would review the bills. So while there was an associate who then became a partner that was working on these cases, that individual, until he became partner, didn't see those final bills, didn't see what they called the pre-bills, which is where all of the attorney's work was set forth, didn't see any of those things. And that's, in fact, how this was discovered, is that that associate became partner, was told that the respondent was stealing his time, so for the first time, pulled those bills and looked through them and discovered these discrepancies. So that's correct.
Did the firm retain the clients, or did they lose the clients?
The firm retained 2 of those clients that still are with the firm today and lost 1 of those clients. Going back to Serengeti, and I want to make this very clear, is that only 1 client used Serengeti, only Beverly. The other 2 clients that were involved, AlterCare and Covenant Care, did not use Serengeti. So even if we can accept respondent's proposition that he should have been provided Serengeti records in order to provide exculpatory evidence to him, that would only apply to that 1 client. The other clients came, well, 1 of the clients came. 1 client chose not to participate, but he came and he testified how he expected his records to be and that they didn't use an electronic billing system. What's even most interesting about this is that the other associate that worked on the case, Victor DeMarco, who then became the partner that discovered the discrepancies, he worked under, as respondent testified, under respondent's supervision. He did not bill in the same manner that respondent billed. His billing statements, as he testified, accurately described the work that he completed on the client's behalf, the amount of time it took to complete that, and the day on which it was completed. If we believe respondent's assertions that the way he billed, where it didn't matter what the narrative said and that there was no correlation, he would have, one would assume, directed his associate, his other partner, to bill in that same way. And there was no evidence that that was the case. Victor DeMarco testified that he was not ever directed to bill in any other manner than that what we generally expect attorneys to bill in, writing in a narrative that's accurately describing the work completed in the amount of time it's completed and on the day it's completed. One other thing I would...
Who handles the work for the firms that were retained, the clients that were retained?
Victor DeMarco continues to handle those clients.
So he went from associate to partner and has the clients that the respondent had before he turned in Mr. Smith?
No, sir. He was an associate. He became partner. He became partner at the beginning of 2007. He was working with respondents still on those long-term care cases. In April of 2007 is when he was told that the respondent was stealing his time. So it wasn't as though he's taken those clients as his own prior to turning in respondent. The last thing I want to comment on, I think I still have a few minutes, very quickly, is the motion for summary judgment that was filed. This court has never determined one way or another whether summary judgment is applicable in disciplinary cases. And I would assert for several different reasons is that it is not. The first is that the rules themselves don't provide for it. What the rules say is that we should follow the civil rules wherever practicable. In looking at the motion for summary judgment in this case, and what I'd suggest for future cases, is that it is not practicable given the direction that the panel and the board has to consider mitigating evidence and aggravating evidence. Those things cannot be presented in a motion for summary judgment. Unless there's any other questions, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Donchance, you have less than 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, now you see the basic misunderstanding in this case. The clients in this case were subrogated. So when the relator stands up here and tells you what the clients did or didn't do, that's missing the point. Those clients are over here. They were subrogated. It was the insurance companies that were driving the litigation.
But didn't your client have a duty to give good information to the clients?
Absolutely, he did.
And did he not fail in that responsibility?
I don't think he did, because we never saw the end product from Serengeti. So there was no way to compare all the pre-bills and everything that we saw in the hearing.
I think Serengeti could not create a narrative. You said that part of this problem is that there's repetitive narratives that have little or nothing to do with the cases, especially at the juncture in which they were inserted into the timesheets or whatever he was keeping his records on. And so it certainly wasn't a situation where Serengeti was providing a narrative. They were merely using your client's narrative.
But Serengeti was actually setting the policy on how those narratives should look. We never saw the billing policies from the insurance companies that the clients were bound to follow as part of their coverage. We never
they
saw those.
They weren't replicating the language on numerous entries inappropriately, like your client, I think it's... You would agree that your client was creating the narratives, correct?
He was, yes.
And they found fault with his handwritten notes, that they were repetitive, that they didn't make any sense at the juncture in which they were being entered on these cases, and then there was a host of problems with them. That's the finding, correct?
I understand that. I don't agree with that finding. I don't think that's what the transcript supports. On the one instance of repetitive billing that we looked at, the testimony from Scott, which was wholly unrebutted, was that he sat down on a Friday afternoon and he did his monthly summaries on, let's say, 20 open cases. So the repetitive entry would be case summary to client, with the same amount of time for each one, because he was going on to Serengeti and he was filling in a form.
What about the claims that he was taking Mr. DeMarco's time and billing for that?
That turned out not to be the case. The client instructed him, for when an attorney was not pre-approved to work on a case but had to work on a case, that they could take that time, bill it under Scott's name. And Scott testified that what he did was go to Western Herd's internal billing people and make sure that the appropriate attorneys got credit for the appropriate time. Again,
was that shown?
It was, but those communications are in Serengeti.
No, I'm saying, did your client bring in the folks that could say, yes, Mr. Smith told us that he was billing for Mr. DeMarco's time, but in reality, everybody knew it was Mr. DeMarco's?
I believe the billing clerk did testify to that. I would have to look back at the transcript, but I don't remember that being an open issue at the end of the case. I think that was taken care of in the testimony.
And counsel, you don't dispute that the Serengeti was related to one client, not the other four?
I do dispute it. It wasn't related to any of the clients because they were subrogated. It was related to the three insurance companies. That's who mandated it. And Scott testified that while John Goodman didn't use it, he didn't choose to use it, he wanted the handwritten or the printed out narratives, his TPA made him use it. And they're the ones who actually referred John Goodman to him for service. So I don't agree with that at all. I think the record shows that the insurance companies wanted these intranet systems because they were so afraid of the bills being discoverable in a punitive damages setting.
Do you disagree the subpoena was quashed because it was not filed in a timely way?
I do not disagree with that, but I don't think that that was a valid exercise of the panel's power. All we wanted was to look at the Serengeti. That could have been accomplished within an hour. It didn't require anybody to print up millions of documents. All they had to do was let us have supervised views of that system. It was still operating. So I think the panel should have let us look at it. At somewhere along the line, they should have let us look at it.
How many days were involved in the hearing before the panel?
3 days, three full days, Your Honor.
And that took place where?
In Cleveland at the Bar Association.
And that's also where the records are maintained.
That's right, right down the street, Your Honor.
Right.
Yep. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decisions. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.